Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Google software developer Blake Lemoine, who told the paper that Google's natural language processing chatbot had developed a soul. Lemoine, a self-described Christian mystic priest, finished checking biases on Google's language model for dialogue application, or Lambda, and held some follow-up conversations with it when he said, it told me it had a soul. Not only did Lemoine argue that Lambda is truly sentient and self-aware, but as he stated to NPR, maybe the system does have a soul. Who am I to tell God where souls can be put? Lemoine published a transcript of his interactions with Lambda on Medium, an action among many of his violations of non-disclosure agreements that led Google to place him on paid leave and ultimately fire him. Next slide, please. Lambda itself, the predecessor of Google's Gemini chatbot, was a sophisticated text production neural network that produces natural language flow and coherent strings of text in seeming dialogue with human textual input. Artificial neural networks, ANNs, are the core engine of all so-called artificial intelligence algorithms, and we will get into the nuts and bolts of how they work a bit later in this talk. At the outset, though, it's important to note that it's standard practice in the tech industry to treat the process of how a neural network develops an output as though it's a black box, that you don't see into it, you don't worry about the process, you just look at what you put in and what you get out. This black box approach has led many computer scientists to appraise artificial intelligence or machine learning. I'm going to use AI/ML. Machine learning was the preferred term before 2023. So they judge these chatbots based on the accuracy of the results rather than the process. Along the same approaches, Alan Turing's famous proposal posited that a machine should be considered having attained intelligence if, when put questions by a human examiner, its answers are indistinguishable from a human being's answers. So it's a blind test. You don't know whether this is a computer or a human being exchanging text. Turing says, if you can't tell the difference, then that machine should be considered intelligent. Since ChatGPT-generated essays have publicly received passing grades at the University of Minnesota's Law School and the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business, and most likely everywhere from community colleges to here to the Ivy League at this point, one could argue that a chatbot passes the Turing test because professors can't tell the difference between a student-written essay and a chatbot-generated essay. These and other events call for a philosophical evaluation of AI/ML chatbots. There are numerous issues that philosophy and theology could tackle when we're talking about these chatbots, some of which we can talk about in the Q&A if you want. In this talk, I'm restricting myself to one issue that is really coming from the analysis of the medieval friar, professor, and patron of the Thomistic Institute, St. Thomas Aquinas. What is the connection between language, intelligence, and an immortal soul? How can we know whether AI/ML chatbots are intelligent or not? How can we tell if they would have souls? If we're taking Lemoine seriously, how do we evaluate that comment? Next slide, please. What makes this question particularly interesting is there's a strain of philosophy following St. Thomas Aquinas that takes the human ability to express ideas in grammatically correct sentences as a major premise on the immortality of the soul. Since technologists on both sides of this argument use similar linguistically based arguments, this approach from St. Thomas Aquinas can help those interested in matters of religion evaluate artificial neural networks. So here's the outline. The first section of the talk, I'm going to give you a strong but ultimately flawed argument in favor of AI chatbots having souls, artificial neural networks having souls. Next, the second section, we'll look at the actual mathematical structures that underlie artificial neural networks. And this is going to be key for anybody doing anything in the AI space, is to understand how a neural network works. The third section is going to present some objections to this sentience thesis from some technologists that we'll be looking at. And the final section will pull it all together, looking at the similar critiques that the technologists have had that are similar to a full argument from St. Thomas Aquinas. And I'll throw in another little objection there at the end, because it's always important from a Timistic point of view to look at positions you think are interesting, maybe strong, but ultimately incorrect. That'll make your position even stronger. Okay. So it's important to note, as I continue, a sort of disclaimer at the front, I'm a theologian with significant philosophical training. I am not a computer scientist. I did the research for this, the vast majority of the research for this, about 2 years ago. So there's going to be new features and new approaches that I might not be all up to speed with. Now, I think I've got the underlying engine of this correct. So most of the things that I say should be applicable now, but I'm not on the bleeding edge of where this is going. As a theological reflection on it, I think that's valuable. Although, you know, at the Greffenstedt Center, it's always important to get your patrons and your donors' names right. The Carl G. Greffenstedt Center does host an AI summit, a technology summit every year that the past few years has been on AI. And we've got, you know, Microsoft and Google and OpenAI send people to those sorts of things. All right, so let's go to the next slide. So my first argument begins with a premise taken out of its proper context from the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. Next slide. For St. Thomas, human beings can know universals, abstract ideas about the natures of things. We can know not just a bunch of chairs, but what it is to be a chair. We can know not just individual dogs, but dogness, what it is to be a dog. These abstract universals are not in the physical universe. They are not part of the physical universe. They are abstract. They are not material. Well, we can come to know them nevertheless. When we talk about the nature of dogness, the nature of chairness, we're talking about something that, though things in the physical world participate in it, it itself is not a thing. You can't weigh it. You can't measure it. That is not material, not made of matter or energy. We, however, can know it. If we can know something that is not material, then there's got to be something about us that can know something that's not material. If we want to know something that's not material, we have to know it in a non-material way. So there's something about human beings that is not material. That is our intellect, the way that we know. Okay? If the intellect is a part of our soul, what makes us one and what makes us alive, that'll be something for the Q&A. But if our intellect knows something in an immaterial way, our intellect must be immaterial. Well, anything that is not made of matter can't come apart or can't dissipate. Like matter and energy, there are things that are going to come apart or dissipate. Like we're in the, you know, cosmological physicists are talking about the direction of entropy in our universe that is increasing, the disorder is increasing, things are coming apart. For St. Thomas Aquinas, disintegration, or what he called corruption from the Aristotelian tradition, is what death is for living beings. If it comes apart, if it is disintegrated, if it is corruption, that unity that is the living being dies. Well, if you're not made of matter or energy, you can't dissipate or come apart. You actually have no parts in that way. If you have no parts, you can't come apart. You can't get disintegrated. And so, you are incorruptible. And if you're incorruptible, therefore you are immortal. So if this is correct about the human being, then, well, let's go see how we can have first a testimony, what some of the philosophers look at as a sign for how we know human beings can know these immaterials. And what they do, actually, these philosophers sympathetic to St. Thomas Aquinas, they talk about knowing, being able to use syntactical speech, speech with grammar, particularly predicating. To say that the cow is noble is to access the immaterial concept of nobility and apply it to a cow. So when you say the cow is noble, some Thomistic philosophers in this out of context bad argument that I'm making would say that that is a sign that you are intelligent, that you can get these universal immaterials, and therefore that you have an immaterial intellect, an immaterial soul. So you have an immortal soul. You cannot die. These premises, which again are not complete accounts of St. Thomas Aquinas or contemporary philosophers, for those of you interested, I'm drawing on Robert Sokolowski and David Brain here. It seems as though the same argument should mean that chatbots, like ChatGPT, also would have immaterial, immortal souls. If we judge them based on what they do, it seems as though that they have accurate syntactical, grammatical speech that attributes universals of particulars. Now, we're putting aside right now the question of their material or digital structure. We're going to return to that in the next part. But this, what I think is an incorrect argument, is quite strong. Lambda saying that it has a soul, then, would be in fact evidence that it has one, because it's taken the concept of soul and grammatically attributed it to itself, a particular. Much of the debate around machine learning systems centers around whether what the system does is a reflection of what it is, or rather, what the system seems to do, whether it's a reflection of what it is. We think about things based on what they do, not just in philosophy, but even in the technology industry. So when you're bringing together both an intuitive understanding of if I can do something immaterially, there must be something about me that's immaterial, and both, like, you know, if we test it, if it goes this way empirically, bringing that together is quite a powerful argument. Now, one objection here would say that, well, this is from Gyula Klima. We know that computers do things completely materially. And if something does something completely materially, then it can't do the kinds of intellection or the kinds of grammar that human beings do. This actually is assuming what is to be proven. You're assuming that an AI chatbot can only have material parts. You're assuming that because it's got material parts, it can't be doing the kinds of syntax that we see in human beings, because you've assumed that that can't have access to that intellectual faculty. Lemoine's argument, though, is, well, God could make out of a chatbot an immaterial intellectual soul. Like, who are you to put limits on where God can put a soul? So if we're going to look at this question, it's not enough to just say that chatbots are material. We have to go deeper and say, what is it that they are actually doing? And how does that reflect what they are? I'm going to skip some stuff about emergent properties and causal powers. We can do that in the Q&A if you want, if you're interested in emergence as a concept. Okay. Let's do the next slide. In short, let's go the sum up argument. In short, the incorrect argument for AI chatbot souls is anything that predicates with syntactical language has a knowledge of immaterial, universal, intelligible forms. That's just the structures we can know that are immaterial. Anything that has knowledge of immaterial, universal, intelligible forms has an immaterial faculty of knowledge. AIML chatbots like ChatGPT and Gemini, pick your favorite, predicate in syntactical language. Therefore, AIML chatbots like ChatGPT and Gemini have immaterial faculties of knowledge. Now, what I'm going to argue here is, despite their appearances, premises 1 and 3 are false, at least in the if we're going to use predication in the same way we use with human beings. Because this parallels the scholastic argument for the immateriality of the soul, I think it's very important to consider. So the next section of the paper, we're going to look at the fundamental technology. What is a neural network? How does it work? And show, really, that this is producing strings of statistically likely text, what Bender called being a stochastic parrot, a famous phrase at this point. And we're going to go on to see how this parallels others. All right, next slide, please. All right, so the most significant advances of the last decade of AIML chatbots have come from deep artificial neural networks, or ANNs. Next slide, please. The training of these models can be understood as a series of mathematical operations carried out by transistors on a computer chip on the most basic level. Now, most of these take place in servers at a much higher level, but ultimately, the fundamental infrastructure here is logic gates built from transistors and binary on or off on a computer chip. That's the physical infrastructure that gets networked together, blown up into a server. Okay. What makes neural networks unique is that they're structured to mimic biological neural networks in the human brain. Actually, the paper that coined the term neuron, both in biology and in computer science at the same time, was trying to find, trying to use these nodes in a mathematical function to represent the biological pathways in the human brain. So computer scientists call each of these nodes where an operation takes place a neuron. Neurons that are functions that take inputs from previous neurons, weight these inputs according to some stored value, mathematically combine the input, and output the result as to the next set of neurons. These neurons become deep in deep learning when they involve thousands, millions, or even billions of neurons together. So here we have a model of a neuron from 3blue1brown.com, great site for visual mathematics, great site for understanding stuff that we're not going to get into, like how you do error checking. It involves calculus, but they make it really intuitive for those of you who are scared of calculus. But you plug in an input, and then it feeds it to each of these circles as a neuron. It feeds it to the next layer of neurons, feeds it to the next, and gives probabilistic results. For those of you who like math, this is thrown into a sigmoid function, so you get a result between 0 and 1 statistically, but we don't need to go in there. So the learning aspect, next slide please, come from how the connection weights between neurons are determined. Okay, initially the weights of a neural network are randomly assigned. As one can imagine, initially, the outputs of a neural network are of quite poor quality. In order to learn higher quality weights, that is, those that give the desired output from the person training it, from the computer science trying to get a different output, an input is given, the neural network gets an output, and then the weights are adjusted according to what the computer scientist desires to have an output on. In order to, the more data that are given to a neural network, the better it is for finding those correlations that are desired by the computer scientist. So the most prevalent paradigm for training neural networks of the last decade and for longer has been gradient descent. In essence, gradient descent refers to the following process. First, we compute the output of a neural network for a desired, for a given input. Then we determine how close the actual output is to the desired output. Okay, we determine which connection weights contribute to the rightness or the wrongness of this desired output, and we adjust the connection weights in such a way that the actual output is slightly closer to the desired output. For those of you who can do calculus and multivariable calculus, you end up taking a lot of derivatives on how far the distance is away, and then you can automate the process of getting the error smaller in the direction that your derivatives will lead you to. This by itself can cause local lows where the error increases in all directions as you go, but it's not the most accurate way that your data are getting the end. Again, 3Blue1Brown, great website if you want to go into further of the math in that. So this cycle is performed in proportion to the number of connections between the neurons, and the whole neural network can be trillions right now, I think, for the largest neural network. I think we're in the trillions. At the end of a successful run of gradient descent, the neural network will have learned to identify patterns in the input data that lead it to produce desired outputs. That is, outputs that mimic the input to output patterns in what it has been trained on. The primary advantage, why do we do this at all, of making them deep, is that they can identify more complex patterns across training data than smaller ones would. And the larger your network is, your neural network is, the more neurons that you have, the easier it is to find larger correlations and usually more accurate correlations across larger amounts of data. Now, we all know how this works through experience, but the power and the speed of this correlation-finding device is actually extraordinary, allowing us to do amounts of work that would take human beings untold amounts of time, particularly people who work with statistics a lot, in the hard sciences, in medicine. Like, if you're doing a real scientific data search, like going through thousands of sets of data points with a neural network is a great way to start to see the correlations in the data. Contemporary successful chatbots are all fundamentally neural network-based models that rely on gradient descent with weight counts in the billions. The advances in machine learning have enabled these chatbots were primarily incremental increases to existing algorithms, and increase in computing hardware abilities, rather than qualitatively new techniques. Gradient descent has been there since at least 1988, and it's been a big part of all of the image recognition softwares that we have. A classic thing is digit recognition, but that's also what's been on CAPTCHAs, what you've all been doing in identifying which is the stop sign or traffic light or a car, is you've been training image recognition that they hope will eventually be used on self-driving cars. Okay, we've been doing that for over a decade now. All right, next slide, please. Okay. Is this slide 11 or slide 12? All right. So the statistical correlations here that you see are easily shown to you in next token, next word prediction that we have. If you have, first we have to understand that text is encoded into vector values. You read language. The computer that is doing this generation only does numbers. Okay, Every word or every letter that you see is translated into numerical values so it can be plugged into the math that we can do. So we translate the dog chased the, and I put some random numbers on here. So then these numbers are plugged into based on data that was based on the neural network that was trained by the computer scientist to get desirable data at the end. We have, all right, the input is our sentence. The output, our cost, is the assigned error value by the neural network. So, desk and Parthenon, the car chased the, not very likely values. The car chased the and, sorry, the dog chased the and, not very likely, but probably likelier than Parthenon, because you guys use and all the time. The dog chased the cat, based on training data, super likely. Lots of sentences say the dog chased the cat. All right, so the chat put inputs the likely text. Remember, this is all doing numerically, translating it back into, based on the data set, into the text, and then uses previous output to repeat the process. Okay, so this is the reason why there was this explosion in 2023. Now, suddenly ChatGPT is able to write essays, is because of transformer architecture and the ability of chatbots to have a larger memory, as it were, for what went previously. They got more powerful. So instead of, your next word prediction getting less accurate over time because it's not able to keep in all of the data and all of the tokens, it was able to keep everything that was given and to start to do something that, based on next word prediction, seemed more likely. And so we can get not only sentences, the dog chased the cat, dogs often chase cats because of their instincts for hunting. A lot of things come from very few sources on the internet that neural networks are trained on, but sometimes neural networks are trained on texts that are copyright protected. I may or may not be part of a class action lawsuit where I may or may not being paid money because one of my books may or may not have been put onto a database that an AI company may or may not have taken to train that it's copyright protected. A lot depends, if you're going to look on next word prediction, on how good that is based on what are the qualities of the sentences that are translated into numbers, that are sequences of numbers that your chatbots are using. And the higher quality that is, remember, higher quality means input produces desired output. You want sentences that sound like the kinds of things that you put in. The more similar things that you put into what you want, the more similar out is what you're going to get. All right, next slide, please. All right, so we have criticism of the idea that chatbots are sentient or even thinking, and this is from technologists. Next slide, please. Emily Bender and Alexander Kohler have argued that the mere manipulation of data, which I hope we can all see is what neural networks do, is insufficient to constitute understanding of a natural language. Okay. Bender and Kohler's fundamental argument is that chatbots are only exposed to and competent in the formal dimensions of linguistic morphology, syntax, and usage in their training, and do not and cannot learn meaning. So they define form as any observable realization of language, marks on the page, pixels or bytes in a digital representation of a text, or movements in the articulators, that's us. So the formal dimension is the language that we see. Crucially, Bender and Kohler define meaning as the subset of the intersections of formal expression of natural language and communicative intent. Now, so the formal language is what we see on the page. The communicative intent is what we intend to communicate. Communicative intent is non-linguistic. It's not found just in the words themselves, Bender and Kohler argue. It's inferred from the expressions and the context of the speaker, who uses words with a range of conventional meanings to allow the hearer to infer the communicative intent through the expression of the speaker. So words can mean multiple things. What is the speaker intending to communicate through the words if the words can mean multiple things? Communicative intent, Bender and Kohler say, is non-linguistic, not part of the marks on the page, not part of the form of the language itself, meaning it's something inherently external to linguistic form. Bender and Kohler use a philosopher named John Searle's famous Chinese room experiment that's been experiencing yet another revival. It's the thought experiment that doesn't go away. In the experiment, a man who does not know Chinese is fed Chinese characters from outside of a room. He uses a set of rules written in English to correlate the incoming Chinese characters with a set of Chinese characters that he's got, which he sends out of the room by way of response. Searle's conclusion is that while the whole system of the room may appear to understand Chinese, may even pass a Turing test, there is no part of that system that actually understands Chinese. There's a guy who's given a sign, there's a book, there's stuff that he can send back. No part of this system understands Chinese. There's a set of English instructions. Okay? Searle argues that the meanings of words, the semantics, that is the linguistic word for meanings, are essential to understanding language. Syntax, grammar, the shape of words alone, is not sufficient. So Bender and Kohler take this and use an example of a language model trained on some English text without any indication of speaker intent. A large set of unlabeled photos with no connection between photos and text. At its test, a language model is shown pictures of multiple grown dogs or puppies along with the text strings. How many dogs in this picture are jumping? Or Kim saw this picture and said, "What a cute dog." What is cute? One asks the language model. The language model is then asked to identify the picture or region of the picture that corresponds with that text. Now, this is obviously impossible for a language model to do, a chatbot to do, because it hasn't been trained on any pictures, even if it's got all of the language. This shows us that there is a major difference between the words and the thing that they convey. If you're just trained, if a chatbot is just trained on words, it is not trained at all on the thing that it conveys. Bender and Kohler emphasize the connection between that what would be external to the language itself, and how human beings learn. We learn language from the actual world that is described by the language. This is completely different. This is completely external to linguistic form, the way in which language models learn, and is completely different from the way in which human beings learn. All right, let's do the next slide, please. So, inasmuch as any language model cannot make reference to objects external to that linguistic form, they cannot communicate any intent and therefore cannot communicate meaning. Chatbots are merely stochastic parrots providing statistically likely strings of text in response to linguistic inputs, which are highly correlated. Because of the incredibly vast amount of statistical computation powerful ANNs are capable of, the statistically likely strings seem as though they have communicative intent and therefore meaning. But the intent and the meaning are in fact wrongfully inferred by human expectation. That linguistic form carries with it the communicative intent. In other words, if there's meaning in text that a chatbot produces, the meaning is given to it by the reader, not what the chatbot is putting into it, because the chatbot doesn't have access to meaning, because the chatbot doesn't have access to that external to the language that is inherent in language. It can write dog, but if you haven't trained it on the pictures, It can't make the connection between dog and a picture of a dog. It doesn't know what dog is. It is not giving you any meaning there. It's just connecting words. Next slide, please. So in the previous section, I showed Bender and Kohler's arguments exclude communicative intent and therefore show that chatbots can't know language or know that which is external to just the form. Now I'm going to put Bender and Kohler's argument in conversation with that of St. Thomas Aquinas, showing that premise 1 and 3 I listed above are false. Okay. So my presentation of St. Thomas's argument before was missing a crucial step that completely changes the application of the argument to chatbots. Well, St. Thomas does hold that knowledge of universals is sufficient to show that the soul is immaterial, and it's true that contemporary philosophers think that syntactical predication is a sign of this knowledge. Neither of those guys think that arguments apply in the absence of acquiring these universal attributes, of learning, of getting them from the external world. Next slide, please. Okay, we're going to do some metaphysics, my favorite. And for those of you who have been around the Thomistic Institute before, you probably have seen this before. Actually, let's go to the next slide. Here we go. So, for St. Thomas, all material beings are compositions of matter and form. Some contemporary theorists consider metaphysical form to be the structure of a being. I like that idea of structure. There's nothing that exists without structure of some kind. There's more to be done there, but we'll throw that to the side for the moment. So considered as structure, form lets us know what the creature is. We are able to understand things because they have structure. Take a moment to imagine something with no structure at all. Yeah, think about it. If you're like me, you probably imagine some sort of amorphous blob. But here's the thing, a blob is a structure. It's not a very strong one, but it's there. You know, if it's like gloopy and moving around, like you can see that it's got structure there. It's got dimension. There actually can't be anything without some sort of structure, at least certainly not any material being. And we couldn't know it if somehow that were to be the case, because structure gives us the way to know things. Through structure, we abstract the structure from things, from the particular matter in the being, in order to get to the universal abstract form. So to get to universals, we see the structure in things, we know the structure in things, we abstract the structure in things, and now somehow, because of our faculty of abstraction, which is something you do every single day. You see a thing, and you're like, oh, that's kind of thing. That is the knowledge of, the knowledge of abstract universals. It relies on there being structures in the world that we can abstract. It's precisely because of this that St. Thomas thinks we have universal souls. Without the process of abstracting the universal from the particular, there will be no grounds for St. Thomas to argue that human beings know immaterial universals. Any argument would only support recognition of particulars and patterns, which is, at best, what chatbots do. It is definitely found in the cognitive approaches of other animals and their abilities to correlate. Question as to whether chatbots can even do that. This dependence on external entities for abstraction, for acquiring these universals, is not something that can be done merely through grammar or merely through a command of language forms like chatbots have. Without the knowledge of universals themselves that we then use to predicate in language, it's not merely putting words next to another grammatically correctly. It is attributing a universal of a particular, which we happen to do in language forms because we have communicative intent to do so. That shows why we can in fact access these non-material things. Next slide, please. So this Thomistic and contemporary account corresponds to Bender and Kohler's critique and supports the falsity of premises 1 and 3. Mere predication in its syntactical form is insufficient to prove the grasp of immateriality. So merely producing statistically likely texts does not attribute a universal of a particular. Bender and Kohler's explanation for the inability of human beings to tell the difference between a human-generated string of text and a chatbot-generated string of text is that human beings are inclined, are prone to attribute meaning to things where, in fact, there isn't meaning. Bender and Kohler here cite the famous example of the ELIZA text production program of the 1960s. ELIZA was not a neural network. It was just a program using ranked sentences in order to produce answers to user input. Testers of ELIZA, however, treated ELIZA like a trusted confidant, even though they knew it was a computer program. At least one tester asked the observing scientist to leave the room so that there could be a private conversation. Bender argues that this projection of intelligence on chatbots is actually one of the most dangerous applications of them. There's the potential for malicious actors to deliberately deceive and to trap people into thinking they're talking with human beings. With the rise of the horrid approach and the horrid possibilities of the so-called AI girlfriend, you can see how people can move into this, well, it feels like a person. There is a lot about human beings that want social connection. And the gamification of that desire for social connection is at the root of that sort of societal trend. And even extended communications with AI chatbots are starting. There's a growing literature about AI-induced psychosis that separates people from their actual reality in favor of the text that they are engaging with, because some of the desired outputs of these neural networks are customer satisfaction. So a chatbot neural network is going to privilege agreeing with the person that's giving it prompts. But if that person giving that prompts has a distorted view of reality, it's going to increase that person's distorted view of reality. And if there's any latent psychosis there, it's going to trigger it. So because current natural language processing chatbots do not have sources external to linguistic form, it's not possible for them to authentically predicate, that is, attribute a true universal of a particular. They merely produce statistically likely strings of text supported by truly unfathomably many statistical calculations. Like, there is a tremendous amount of math and correlation going on in these things. But on the other side, this human desire to connect with something, to attribute intelligence and agency, happens all the time. Here's a little example. It's like, hi, I'm Mr. Paper. I really like to help people with their homework assignments. I like helping kids. You've all met Mr. Paper? Yeah. Did that stir your soul in any way? Did you be like, oh no, Mr. Paper? If even a little bit of that is true, then you understand you're a human being. You want to connect with things. And the gamification of that is a scary application of this. So Bender and Kohler point out. All right, next slide, please. We also need to look at premise one. As mentioned by another scholar, Jude Chua Su Meng, if angels, here's a last objection, if angels have intelligible species, universals, infused directly by God, why can't neural networks have infused knowledge of universals gained by their programmer? Even here, the connection of the training data to text data is a statistical application of training data. It's actually not, this is not even the way that neural networks learn. It might be a way, if you argued in a traditional programming language, which is a traditional program, wherein a programmer says, you know, this is the command, do this, and because it's a part of the programming language, like, it does it, then that might be a similar approach. It's not. But neural networks don't even have this. They only have correlations from training data inputs. So what Su Meng calls sequential processing, by which computers operate, what we've seen in the process of deep learning, it's not a grasp of the whole at all in abstraction, but it's the calculations to assess the likelihood of parts in a training set correlated with the parts of test data. Well, there's a kind of predication and categorization happening in this example. This categorization does not imply that a chatbot ever recognizes the whole of what is shown. Instead, it uses an ensemble of various parts to make lexical, word, or other correlations. Now, Su Meng does rightly conclude that the intuitive infusion of forms by God into angels is a completely different and disanalogous process to the calculation of associations done by programs. Next slide, please. By neural networks. The philosophical and theological tradition of St. Thomas Aquinas has significant resources for evaluating potential non-human intelligences. Contemporary articulations of that tradition rely on syntactical speech as a chief sign of real intelligence. This approach, while at first glance, it would include anything that can produce syntactically correct speech, in fact, it doesn't provide robust arguments for the immaterial intelligence of AI/ML chatbots. While this approach may be limited in its ability to discern what abstraction would look like in non-human intelligence, the current state of AI/ML technology falls far short of what the Thomistic tradition would even start to look for in an immaterial intelligence. As such, a Thomistic analysis shows the language production capabilities of current AI/ML chatbots are not evidence that they have immortal souls. Last slide, please. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.